Welcome to Crescent City Crime, dear listeners. I am Tracy.
And I'm Brian.
And as always, we want to start off by thanking everybody who listens to us. And we have a kind of a special moment here. This is our 25th episode.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I know it's been a while since I've asked you to come on this podcasting journey with me. Thank you for coming on it with me.
Well, you're most welcome, sweetheart. I love doing this with you.
And I love doing this with you, too. And we love the people who listen to us. We don't know you, but we love you, and we deeply, deeply appreciate you.
Thank you for listening. You know, we love it when you listen to us. We love to talk to you.
We really do. And, of course, make sure that you tell a friend about us. And make sure that you rate and review this podcast on your preferred podcasting platform. And, of course, thank you to Lucy, who manages our TikTok feed.
Thank you, Lucy.
And that is all of the housekeeping that we have to do right now. And today we're going to be talking about a mysterious death. Brian, when you think of Lakeview, the neighborhood Lakeview in New Orleans, Louisiana, what do you think of?
I think of people who love to live close to the lake and very nice houses, people with money.
Right.
Especially the people who literally live along the lake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what is the one thing you don't really associate with Lakeview?
Low-income housing is one.
Well, I was going for crime.
Well, it depends on what kind of crime you're talking about.
Murder.
Okay. No, you would not associate murder with Lakeview. What you would associate is car burglaries.
Property theft.
Yeah, property theft, because a certain part of the criminal element, it seems, has always believed that's where you go to get a score is Lakeview, because they have money.
Right.
It's not the only part of the city where people live who have money, but that is the mentality of that element of criminals.
Exactly. But as we've already said, you don't really associate murder with Lakeview.
No.
But today's story revolves around a likely murder in Lakeview.
Oh.
Jessica Easterly Durning lived with her husband, Justin, and his daughter, Grace. They lived in the Lakeview neighborhood in New Orleans, Louisiana. Not a whole lot is known about their marriage, but one thing that is known is that Jessica and Justin, they made money by being on a website that featured homemade adult movies. And Jessica and Justin used the personas Vivian and Lance. These were their adult film star persona names. And it is also known that Jessica embraced being a stepmother to Grace. And she loved Grace very, very much. It is also known that on August the 12th of 2019, Jessica frantically called her friend Maria Creel to pick her up, saying that she felt afraid to stay in her home. Maria says that she did not go into specifics, only that she needed to leave. But for Maria, it was a two-hour drive from her home, and she did not have anybody to pick up her kids from school. So she couldn't make it that evening, but she planned to pick her up the next morning. But the next day, she got a text from Jessica canceling.
So she thinks she got a text from Jessica.
Yes.
Because the tricky thing about receiving a text message from someone's phone is technically you've received the text message from a device.
Right.
You don't know who actually sent the text.
Well, I propose that if you know somebody very well and you know they're texting, like when somebody texts, right, they could use instead of, you know, saying ha ha, they might say lol, or they might say I can't talk to you right now, I'll call you in a sec, instead of saying a second. Like you can
recognize,
right?
The syntax that your friends use,
right?
Just the same as if you can be wise enough to catch on to an online scammer. When the online scammer follows up on this email you've sent them, if you're foolish enough to do this, and then all of a sudden, the cut and paste that the scammer used is replaced with someone who is obviously speaking English as a second language.
Right.
Like when the scammer asks you, what is your mode of payment, for example, that should raise a red flag right there and thinking, this does not sound like an American. That's not the way we talk, you know, just for example. Right. So it's the same principle.
Exactly. So we don't exactly know who sent that text message, but Maria never heard from Jessica again. 2 days later, Jessica's husband messaged Maria using Jessica's Facebook account. I want to stress this. Her husband went into Jessica's Facebook and used her account to message Jessica's friend. And he told her that he could not find Jessica and claimed that he had contacted the New Orleans Police Department. Now, Brian, how do you, aside from a laptop, how do you typically access Facebook?
From a phone.
From a phone. So put a pin in that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. This is getting very sketchy.
Already.
Yes. Yes.
2 weeks later, New Orleans Police Superintendent Sean Ferguson said that the NOPD is seeking to locate an adult female reported to be missing. The reporting person said that he last observed Jessica Easterly Durning, born on August the 17th, 1976, at their residence on August the 14th, 2019, in the 6000 block of General Haig Street. When he woke that afternoon at 3:30, the reporting person discovered Jessica was not at the residence and has not been seen or heard from since. 2 days after this statement, Jessica's sisters Amanda and Audra and their cousin Doug arrived in New Orleans to look for Jessica. Before meeting with detectives, Doug suggested checking the Lakeview neighborhood near Jessica's home to consider how they might organize a search party. Two blocks from Jessica's apartment near Kenilworth Street and Orleans Avenue, which is on the outskirts of City Park, they noticed a foul smell. They stopped the car to investigate, and they found Jessica's body lying in the grass, decaying in the hot August sun.
Oh, that's a very nasty smell, at the very least. And it's a pretty mortifying sight to find the body of anyone's body in such a manner. And of course, it's even worse when it's someone you know.
And I just want to point out, her body had been there for at least a week. At least a week, just lying in the grass by some overgrowth near City Park. I mean, that is a traveled intersection. It's not exactly remote or desolate.
You would think someone else would have picked up on this peculiar odor,
or even seen the body.
Yeah, and you'd also think that perhaps if the husband is so innocent in this, that he would have found her sooner.
That too.
Then this almost seems like he was trying to manipulate her friends into finding the body.
Oh, I didn't think of it that way. You could be right. Yeah, he sounds like he's not a prize, so I would not be.
It seems like he knew where the body was at the very least.
Which
would be pretty. Which is pretty bizarre and pretty sketchy, pretty suspicious right there.
In order to officially identify her remains, because the body was in an advanced state of decomposition. I mean, the August sun and the heat in the world is going to do things to dead bodies. There's also a lot of insect life, possibly even some wildlife had come and well, you know,
the body's gonna bloat.
That too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You've been there.
I've been there. I've seen that in the sands, 12,000 miles away. A dead enemy that's half buried in the sand because of the way things work over there, and bodies bloated. Kind of an image I would like to unsee, but you know, we know the deal there.
I'm sorry. In order to officially identify her remains, police swabbed Jessica's mother for DNA in September, but in October, the NOPD reported losing the DNA sample before it reached the coroner's office. You believe that?
That sounds pretty strange.
So new DNA was collected, and they confirmed Jessica's identity on November the 8th of 2019. On January the 24th of 2020, Jessica's stepfather, Rick Schmidt, and her sister, Audra, returned to New Orleans for an update from the NOPD and to view the coroner's report. In an unsurprisingly incompetent move, detectives told them that the cold case was not active. And to make things worse, the coroner's report said that Jessica suffered a fractured nose, a broken jaw, broken ribs, and a broken C4 vertebrae, commonly referred to as a broken neck. In spite of these injuries, the coroner listed Jessica's death cause of death as undetermined.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, C4, that, you know, fourth thoracic vertebrae, which is common if someone's neck has been broken during a struggle.
Do you not survive if your C4 vertebrae is broken? Because I know that
you typically don't. No.
Okay. Because I know that some, like, depends on where your spine is broken, can determine if you're a paraplegic or a quadriplegic or dead, right?
Right. That's very close. That's pretty close to the brainstem.
Yeah. The New Orleans Parish Coroner's Office released a statement saying that advanced changes of decomposition can make determining cause and manner of death difficult, as it did in this case. Limited decomposition toxicology testing of liver tissue did test positive for methamphetamine and an antidepressant, but it is unclear if these results reflect recent intake, but a drug-related death cannot be ruled out. Seriously?
Oh, well, we know everybody's, vertebrae gets fractured by doing drugs. Yeah, sure.
It totally happens. Meth, not even once.
Because
meth will break your neck, you know.
Yeah, totally break your neck. You're more likely to fracture phalanges.
Because you punch something.
Under the influence. So, by punching something really, really hard.
Yeah, which...
In anger, I under the influence of...
PCP.
PCP is what's most common, but it could be meth as well. But, yeah, all these signs of a fight, including a broken neck, it's pretty bizarre to call that drug-related.
And I'm also pretty confident that if you're walking through Lakeview at nighttime, you're not going to encounter somebody a random stranger who would do such things to you. Lakeview is pretty quiet at night.
Well, if an armed robber comes after you in Lakeview, the person's going to use a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any struggle, you're going to get shot.
Right.
You're not going to get beaten up and bruised up and have your neck broken.
Right.
No, you're going to get shot if there's a struggle and an attempted robbery.
Exactly.
Or a drug deal gone bad.
Or a drug deal gone
right.
bad. Yeah.
They're just going to shoot you and leave and maybe take your money. Maybe.
The NOPD told reporters that week that the investigation into Jessica Durning's death remained open and active. So they changed their minds from it being a cold case, an inactive cold case, to all of a sudden an active investigation. Interesting, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Change of priorities, huh?
Yes. Jessica's family, and I need to add that this does not include her husband. Her husband, or Justin, seemed to be pretty useless during this investigation or getting any pressure from the NOPD on this or at all, okay? Her family reached out to the Louisiana State Police and to the district attorney's office to join the investigation. On March the 15th of 2020, a couple who lived in the same Lakeview neighborhood that Jessica did found her ID card in a blanket just yards away from the location where Jessica's family discovered her body 7 months earlier. So they called the police, Brian, and they were told to collect this evidence themselves.
That's lazy detective work.
It very much is, and it's going to get even lazier. Are you ready for this? The couple did collect those items, even though it should have been collected by detectives.
Yeah.
And it took the NOPD an additional 6 months to follow up with the couple and retrieve the items from them.
Wow.
Yeah. In April of 2020, Audra, Jessica's sister, filed a formal complaint with the Public Integrity Bureau against the NOPD for failing to properly investigate the death of Jessica Easterly Durning. And then 4 months later, on August 6th of 2020, the Public Integrity Bureau notified Audra that an audit of the police investigation was underway. Can you explain how an audit in a police investigation works?
Well, essentially, Public Integrity Division is going to review any reports filed in the matter, and they're going to talk to everyone involved, top to bottom. They're typically going to start. They're going to start with the highest point of the chain of command that was, you know, on it, like the district. That they'll typically talk to the shift sergeant,
right,
who was on duty at the time, and go down from there. Perhaps the watch commander first.
Okay.
And they're going to go in with a headhunter's mindset. They're going to be looking for violations of department procedure first and violations of the law second. And the typical Public Integrity Division approach, of course, is going to be disciplinary action if anything was violated.
And
they're very adamant about it. This would be a case where I would hope that their overzealous nature over the last several years comes in. That's, you'd hope to see that here.
You mean the investigative bureau, their overzealousness will help in this case?
I would certainly hope so. Because there are situations where they get incredibly nitpicky.
Right. But this needs to be nitpicked.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much so.
Do they ever release the results of these investigations to the public?
Not always. It depends on whether or not it's high profile.
Well, this unfortunately and doesn't
whether
seem
or not
to be...
they're getting badgered by media.
Well, this doesn't really seem to be as high profile as it probably should be. I'm going to also add here that Jessica Easterly was a white woman. And we all know that white women, dead white women, tend to get more media coverage than dead women of color. And, of course, Lakeview is an affluent neighborhood and a quiet neighborhood. So this didn't really blow up as much as it probably should have.
I think one big reason why it didn't was because she was marginalized as a sex worker.
You're correct. And I was actually going to bring that point up, but yes, you're right. That is probably why. In February of 2021, Jessica's remains, after 500 days in the morgue, were finally released to her family.
That is too long.
Isn't it though?
That is way too long to wait to have a funeral.
Yes.
At the very least.
On October the 20th of 2021, crime scene investigators collected samples from a futon left in front of Justin Durning's home for trash pickup. Now, we don't know what they were looking for or what they collected, but hopefully something is going to be done. And that is really the last bit of crime scene or any sort of evidence collecting that has gone on in this case. The New Orleans District Attorney is investigating as well, but so far, no persons of interest have been named and no arrests have been made. Now we are going to turn our attention to the day she went missing from Justin's point of view. Justin says that the day that she went missing, they took a nap. When he awoke, she was gone. Her cell phone, wallet, and keys were left behind. Now, Brian, what is one thing you would never leave the house without, at the very least?
Your cell phone.
Well, I was going to say your keys.
I mean, if you want to take your you need to unlock. You need to lock the house.
Right. You need to lock your house.
Yeah, that's true. You'll forget your cell phone before you forget your keys.
Yes, and I also like to sing for myself: eyeglasses, wallet, keys, and phone. Just so I remember the things I actually do need to leave the house with.
So apparently on this day, she supposedly leaves the house not only without her cell phone, but without her keys.
And also without her wallet. Her ID card was just found on the ground, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That also makes this incredibly bizarre.
And when you have the fact that a text was sent to her friend canceling her pickup, right? Mm-hmm. And also the fact that Justin used the Facebook Messenger to contact Maria. It sounds to me like Justin, I mean, I'm pretty sure that he stole her phone from her. It is possible that Justin found her phone and saw the text messages in there that she was sending to her friend to come pick her up and got angry enough to kill her. That's what I think.
That is a good theory.
Thank you. Justin did not appear concerned about her disappearance. He said that the last time he saw her was August the 12th, but she was not reported missing until the 14th. And the only reason why police went to Jessica and Justin's house in the first place was because Jessica's friend Maria kept contacting the police to make a welfare check at their house. So it wasn't even her husband who was trying to get the police involved. This was her best friend.
Which of course would be normal, but the husband's, it's very interesting how he waits 48 hours.
Yeah. Now, and I don't know if this is just a thing on TV, but if they say that, you know, like sometimes you'll hear on a TV show, oh, you have to wait 48 hours to make a missing persons report on an adult. Is that true?
It's going to depend upon the municipality.
What about here? Do you need to wait a certain amount
over
of time?
Over here, I believe it's just 24.
Okay. Okay. So, Justin continued posting on social media sites under the adult movie star personas that he and Jessica worked under. Wait, I'm sorry. I read ahead too much. Justin continued posting on social media sites and never once made any public appeal for help. He didn't make a post on Facebook. He didn't make a Facebook page or anything like that. Her family did that.
Then that is peculiar. If his husband really loved her and he's really innocent in this matter, then he should have been leading this effort.
Or at least involved. I mean, even if you don't know how to make a Facebook page involving something, chances are you know somebody who does.
Yeah, you're going to find someone who does.
Yeah, you're going to find someone who does. Yes. So, of course, now, the big question is, what caused this plane to fall out of the sky when it was only 100 feet off the ground? The National Transportation Safety Board investigation concluded that it was a microburst. A microburst is a tight column of sinking air that produces intense straight-line winds at a ground level that are similar to but are distinguishable from a tornado. So it's a very powerful burst of wind, essentially. Wind speeds in microbursts can reach up to 100 miles an hour or even higher. That's the equivalent to an F1 tornado on the Fujita scale. The intensity of a thunderstorm for aviation purposes was measured on a scale of 1 to 6, with 6 being the most intense. A level 1 to 2 storm will have light to moderate turbulence and lightning, but does not pose a significant threat to an airliner. In a level 3 storm, severe turbulence is possible. In a level 4 storm, severe turbulence is likely. A level 5 storm will have severe turbulence, powerful wind gusts, and possible hail. And a level 6 storm features large hail, severe turbulence, and extreme wind gusts. Anything above level 3 is to be avoided at all costs. However, on that day, the pilot's radar did not show any storms above level 2. A report issued by the National Transportation Safety Board on March 25th of 1983 declared that low-level wind shear conditions had been detected by the airport and the system had alarmed several times. The last time was about 4 minutes before Flight 759's takeoff. But the system was not alarming at the time the takeoff clearance was issued. However, a wind shear advisory was broadcast only 2 seconds after the accident. So absorb that for a second. You believe that? That's bad communications relays right there.
Yes. They were taking off in conditions that should not have affected such a large aircraft. Now, for small aircraft, especially turboprop driven,
mm-hmm.
like the Cessna 152 I used to fly, you're going to cancel your flight.
Right.
Even under a level 1.
Right, because it's such a light aircraft.
Yeah, but when landing, you can get, or before you land, you can get caught. Like my most memorable landing was a landing with a, let's see, it was a 20 mile an hour crosswind in rain.
Oh, okay.
So that required a correction of 20 degrees into the wind, 1 degree for every mile per hour.
Okay.
Of wind speed. And it was actually one of my better landings because I was
doing it by the book.
I was concentrating.
Right.
And nervous as hell, of course. But because I was nervous, I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Sometimes it works out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas like with an easier landing, anticipated landing in no wind, you might make that slightly rough by having your wheels bounce.
Right.
You see?
Right.
Whereas you're supposed to keep pulling back on the wheel, in that case a wheel, to literally stop the plane from landing until it literally just completely loses lift and gently sets down the runway, you know.
Interesting.
As the plane eases down, you keep pulling back a little bit. Little more, little more, little more, and then that's it. No more lift. Your wheels smoothly touch the runway. If you achieve a landing where you can't really feel the wheels touch the runway, it's called a greaser landing, which is the smoothest landing there is.
Well, I will make sure to remember that the next time I have to land a plane. The investigation highlighted the risk of what was then a poorly understood weather phenomenon. They found that disaster could have been prevented if the FAA had acted sooner. In the aftermath of this tragedy, local politicians became lobbyists for the development of sophisticated equipment that incorporates Doppler radar to predict severe downdrafts. This virtually eliminated the violent weather phenomenon as a threat to airline safety. Wind shear detection and alert systems were mandated by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration for installation in all commercial aircraft by 1993. When did you first fly a plane? What year was it?
92.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is just a year after that.
Yeah.
Is when these things started to be mandated in aircraft or commercial aircraft anyway. Now the crash also highlighted the need for more runway space. The New Orleans International Airport worked out a revenue sharing plan with neighboring St. Charles Parish so that the airport's east-west runway could be extended into the unpopulated La Branche wetlands, so that planes won't have to take off and land over populated areas. This became a national trend, actually. Other airlines were suffering from the same thing, which was, you know, developments encroaching on very close to airports.
Yeah, and also the longer a runway, the lesser the chance that you will make the runway.
Right.
Because if you determine at any point that you don't have enough runway to stop the plane, you have to add power and take off again and come back around and do your final approach all over again.
Right.
Which I've had to do that. The smaller the aircraft, the more likely you were to actually do that sometimes. And I've had to do it in the Cessna 152. Even F-18 pilots have to do that sometimes when trying to put those planes down on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
Okay. All right. So because we are a true crime podcast, we have to ask the question, did a crime contribute to this disaster? Buried deep within the crash investigation report was news of a broken wind shear detector on the western edge of the runway where Flight 759 took off. It had been damaged by gunshots shortly after it was installed. It was fixed, but it was shot out again. They gave up fixing it, said Brad Dunbar, a spokesman for the NTSB. Ray P. Sick, a safety officer for the professional air traffic controller organization at the New Orleans airport, reported that detector to be in unsatisfactory condition to the Federal Aviation Administration on October the 29th, 1980. So it was out of service for approximately 1 year and 8 months prior to the crash.
That's too long.
Yes.
And so they decided to stop fixing it instead of trying to get law enforcement to catch whoever it was who enjoyed using it for target practice.
Correct. That's exactly what happened. So the evidence to me suggests that, yes, a crime did contribute. It's not the cause, right? I mean, you can't really blame Mother Nature in this way, but you can blame people who have damaged airport safety equipment.
Yeah, illegal discharge of a firearm and criminal damage.
Right. And of course, you know, when things are reported to the Federal Aviation Administration, they don't act on these things. It's negligence.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So speaking of which, the Pan American Airlines and the federal government both faced lawsuits in excess of $3 billion. They accepted blame for the jet crash in a hearing on May the 13th, 1983, in New Orleans, and offered the victims' families an undisclosed amount. Wendell Gauthier, a lawyer representing several of the victims' families, called the move astounding. So they didn't haggle over it in court. They just gave them an undisclosed amount of money.
Yeah, they obviously didn't want this thing to continue on and gain a life of its own and embarrass the federal government.
Yes, the Federal Aviation Administration that the broken windshield detector was reported to, and they didn't fix it.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's gross negligence. It was their job to make sure that those things are working.
A memorial to the victims of Flight 759 was constructed in a garden at Our Lady of Perpetual Help Catholic Church in Kenner, 1 mile from the crash site. Tiles bearing the names of the crash victims are embedded into a low circular wall. And as for Pan Am, which was the world's largest international air carrier that was founded in 1927, ceased operations in 1991 after declaring bankruptcy. And that was one of the things that ended Pan Am Airlines. That they actually have had several incidents. You can, if you want to, anybody who's listening to this, if you want to fall into a rabbit hole of tragedy, you can look up Pan American flight track records, or their track record of how many planes of theirs have had some sort of disaster.
And these are the things that you cause when you don't commit to safety.
That's very true. Safety first, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So that is going to wrap it up for this particular episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we hope that you will join us next week when we are going to talk about a heartbreaking case of a local woman who was most likely killed by her boyfriend. And even though he is the most likely suspect, the case is still unsolved. And it, in my opinion, is largely due to police negligence yet again.
Yes, some of this, and I did forget to mention that police negligence and as well as territorialism hampered efforts to respond to this tragic accident, because for about an entire hour, Sheriff Harry Lee of Jefferson Parish had an argument with, I believe it was Sal Lentini, chief of the Kenner Police, over who had jurisdiction.
Wow.
There.
Wow.
Which it's obviously the Sheriff's Department.
Right.
Which Harry Lee, and you know, always insisting he's right historically. That probably actually lengthened the argument, as it was in this was discussed in my police process class in college. Upon the subject of incidents where two chief law enforcement officers square off over a territorial dispute.
It's like two dogs pissing on top of each other's piss.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yes.
It actually happens.
Yes, it does happen. And we are going to officially finish now. So everybody be safe. Be kind. Remember that we're all human beings. Hug your loved ones and don't park next to vans.
If it's dark, it's dangerous, and you don't feel safe, don't be there in the first place. And if you are ever talking to law enforcement in official capacity and you're not a victim, you're not a victim, then lawyer up.